Okay, gentlemen, we're going to make a start. So I'd like to introduce to you John Thorpe and just mention a few things about John. John Thorpe was a youth minister at Greenacre for 8 years. He's been a youth advisor for YouthWorks for 4 years and he's currently director of ministry support for YouthWorks. He's deeply committed to supporting local churches and thinking through how we as the body of Christ can work together to grow our young people. He's married with 3 children and loves pretty much anything on 2 wheels. Now, John,
yes.
A couple of questions. John, you've had a lot of experience with youth work. What's been one of your most rewarding times as a youth worker?
I've done youth ministry for a long time, so I was at Greenacre for 8 years. Before that, I was in camping. Perhaps one of the most... I loved Greenacre. Greenacre's next to Bankstown. Demographically, it's pretty much at the opposite end of the spectrum of this school. So it's not rich and it's not white. But love being there. And I used to go into Punch Bowl Boys each week. And for Punch Bowl Boys, there's never been a more appropriate name for a school than Punch Bowl Boys. But it was brilliant. We went in there and we got to share the gospel with these young blokes each week. And their life circumstance was always complicated. There was not a single kid in that school where it wasn't complicated. But to be able to go in and share the gospel was brilliant. There was a young bloke who I particularly got to know. His name was Mark. He was the token white Aussie. And he's now, you know, I don't know, probably 27 at this stage. He's married. He's got a kid. And he's a Christian. And his story from where he was there to where he is now is just brilliant. So he's a testament to the glory and the grace of God from Greenacre.
Fantastic. Thank you. John, you love 2 wheels.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been your...
Not very good at it, but I love them.
Which has been your favourite, most loved 2-wheel machine and why?
Yeah, I think I've had 15 motorbikes. 6 didn't quite go the distance. May they rest in peace. Pieces. Probably the first... You've got to love the first. My first bike was a GSX 250. It was a Suzuki. It sounded like a postie bike, pretty much. And in my head, you know, I kind of had, get your motor running. You know, I'm big wild man on this poxy little thing. But loved it. It survived about 1.5 years and then tragically didn't survive any longer.
Terrific. Okay. John, most guys like their food. What would need to be on the menu to entice you?
Go to the restaurant. I look at the menu. I think about all these things. I think I will eat, and in the end, I buy beef. You know, just give me a steak. Yeah. So all the other ones tempt me. Oh, I should. You know, I'm going to branch out. I'm going to live on the edge. But you know, I just like dead cow. So, yeah.
Great. Let's just open in prayer, and we'll hand over to John. Dear Lord, we thank you for this great day we've had today with hearing about how we can live our lives as men and how we can do better. And we just pray that as John speaks today, that you would bless him in his speaking and encourage us in our ministry. Amen.
Thanks, Graham. And it's good to be together for a very brief time, but hopefully something that is helpful for you and for all of us. Just to give you a very quick snapshot of where we're going, the title for today is Connecting Our Young Blokes with the Gospel. In particular, it's men connecting young blokes with the gospel. So I'm not so much going to talk about the role of fathers. That is a brilliant topic. And if you'd been at the session in here, you know, 30 minutes ago, that would have been really helpful. But what I want to focus on today is really... how, as men in the church, we can connect with other young blokes around us. So I want to give you a quick snapshot, a cultural snapshot of what our young blokes are growing up in, what is the world that they're part of, then what our role is in it, and a couple of suggestions about how we can go. Restart your computer. Gee, that sounds bad, doesn't it? Thanks for pointing that out. I might postpone. In 15 minutes' time, it'll probably shut me down. So let me start with a cultural snapshot, and I'm going to do that by showing a brief video that just captures a little bit of what's happening in our world. For those older blokes, you're going to hate the style of this, but try to see through that to the message.
We live in incredible times. For us in the West, things have never been better. Standards of living have never been higher. We've never had so much money to spend on so much stuff. We've never had so many places to visit that are just a jet ride away. Technology offers us this vision of a shiny, hopeful future. We have so many options. The world truly is our oyster. Yet in these incredible times, many of us feel as though our lives are not incredible. Despite all the things we have, all the things that we've experienced, our lives are often lacking. We feel that the good life is always just over the horizon, just out of reach. For those of us who are trying to follow Jesus in these times, things get even more complicated. What sort of faith should we be living out? What do Jesus' teachings say to us? Do they even relate? I believe that if we're going to live in this time, we have to understand our times. A helpful tool for doing this is the concept of hyperreality.
This is the world where all your dreams come true. Here you will always be popular. Your tummy will always tingle with excitement. You will find the perfect partner or partners. It's kind of like a highlight reel with all the best parts that life has to offer, where you can have the lifestyles of the rich and famous and still hang with your friends on the street. Here is always New Year's Eve, Christmas morning, and your birthday all rolled into one. Here you are the most important person in the world. It's all here for you. Look over there. It's Paris Hilton doing Pilates with David Beckham.
The term hyperreality was first coined by French cultural theorist Jean-Paul Rollat in the 1980s. He'd visited America, gone to amusement parks and casinos, and he found that in those places it was hard to tell the difference between that which was real and that which was imagined. He found that there were products that you could buy, such as cherry cola, which didn't even taste like cherries anymore. You could buy pornography, which made normal sex look boring and mundane. He found that what was happening is that people didn't want that which was real anymore. They wanted these new products and experiences that promised to be even better than the real thing. Our whole culture is going in this direction. It tells us that if we're to be happy, we have to go towards the fake, the hyper-real, in order to find meaning and fulfillment.
I'll stop it there. But it does give a very quick snapshot. Obviously, the young people don't identify it like this. This is just the air they breathe. Here's another one. This is an ad campaign that's out at the moment for James Squire's beer. I like James Squire's beer. I'm not so keen on this ad campaign. But look at the byline for it. Today I love Mary, tomorrow Lucy. For another one, today I believe in luck, not in faith. Today I'm myself, tomorrow whoever I want. Now this is, again, the cultural air that our young people are breathing. Life is all about them. It's all about their individual happiness, their individual consumerism. And life is good and life is complete when they are doing what they want for themselves. That is the world that they've been taught. That's the world they've been taught by their parents. It's the world that they've been taught by the media. And they are consuming media at a ferocious rate through the internet, through TV, through video, all the rest of it. This is the life they breathe. So what I want you to do is just with the people around you for a moment, with this very, very brief snapshot, do you think it's a fair cultural observation? And how do you think it's going to shape our young men? So 3 minutes, go for it. Thank you. Let's come back together. And can I throw it open to the floor if people are willing to participate? Do you think it's real? You're welcome to say no, by the way. Nothing like a good bit of debate and a variety of opinion. Do you think it's real, and how do you see it manifesting? Does anyone want to throw open an opinion? Okay, plenty of people. I'm going to start in the middle and then I'm going to go left and right.
Yep.
So they've got a very strong awareness of things like social justice, ecological issues, and that sort of thing. But at the same time, this consumerism and individualism. Absolutely. Yep. So yeah.
And even what is real is unbelievable. Like, there's like a whole Nicholas Sparks movie about a woman who has amnesia, and it's like a Christian couple, but they took away that Christianity from it to make it more believable. And so, like, what is real isn't actually believable anymore, it's what is fake.
Yeah, that's right. So we look at these media images and we expect that they're going to become part of our life. And when they're not, we're profoundly disappointed and surprised. Yeah, and there was one more. Sorry, yep.
Yeah, I guess I see a lot of social media as well today, and it distorts things pretty terribly. And, like, I just look at that ad, and I look at what the ads were like in the past, and, you know, they do things like that. But what I found was that they used to have quite a bit of irony in it. That ad doesn't even try.
Yeah, that's right.
They're not even trying, you know? Like, it's just gone full circle now. And, yeah, like, narcissism, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, some of those things that I think it was... Who had them up this morning? Lee, in his, when he's describing our culture... you can see how this is sort of manifesting itself in our marketing campaigns. It is completely individualistic, completely consumer, and completely context-driven. Let me see if I can push this for longer. 4 hours. There we go. No. Now you've put that into ethics and values, it also becomes very situational, which is, so there's no longer this objective right and wrong, there is this situational right and wrong, which is what is right in this particular context, and in particular, what's right in this particular context for me. So we've gone from thinking from as a society of you know what is the greater good to what is the greater good for me. So it's really just, this is old ethics just rebranded, but it has become the air we breathe of our culture. Let me put a few statistics to things. 35% of our young people will be born outside of a marriage context. Of marriages, 33% will break up. 25% of 15-year-olds will be living with one of their biological parents. So their parents, whether it's de facto or marriage, has now split and their family unit is now something different, either single, blended or something else. 25% of our young people are diagnosed, not just feeling the pressure, diagnosed with a mental illness. And on top of that, another 24%, so another 24%, are feeling severe emotional distress. So all of these stats come out of the Parkinson report that you can get online. If you look up Parkinson for the children's sake, you get all of these pictures. He describes the whole thing as a canary in a mineshaft, that our young people are under an enormous amount of stress. 66%. This is the increase from 1996 to 2006 of the number of 12 to 14-year-olds who are hospitalised for self-harm. It is a very, very there's a significant cultural issue. In our church, to move it a little bit closer to home, because we're talking about ministry to boys, 40-60 is the ratio of males to females. So there's a big cultural issue, but there's also someone that they're missing in our church. And that's true from the age 10 up. So from 10-year-olds up, we've got a 40-60 ratio. If we continue to look at church for a bit longer, this is a graph of church attendance. This is from NCLS. There's a new one about to come out is sort of currently being chewed over. But what we can see is that we do pretty well in youth ministry. 6 to 12, kids ministry, we've got a lot of people coming. So we've got the church kids, and the church kids are bringing their friends, and that's awesome. From 13 to 18, we drop, but, 13 to 18, pretty tumultuous time of life. I think some of us are probably a little pleasantly surprised by that, some a little disappointed. Depending on if the optimists, a little disappointed. The pessimists, a little pleasantly surprised. There's a whole bunch of factors pushing up and down. So pushing up, you're starting to get young people who are maturing in their faith. So we're starting to get a really deep, solid base. Those mature people are inviting their friends. So they're the positive things. On the just social contextual things, you've still got young people who love gathering with other young people. They want to be part of something. They love to be part of a movement. And so church is kind of like a movement. And so that's a cultural factor that's perhaps holding it up. On the negative side, culturally, you've got obviously a lot more freedom once you hit 13 to, or particularly the 15 to 18 mark. And if church is no longer fulfilling your social needs, well, that's okay. You can get that satisfied in lots of other places. You don't need to go to somewhere institutional. You can go to the local BP and just hang out there for the evening, and that's just as good. And then 19 to 25, you've just got a whole... It's just like off a cliff. And literally, it's half of what we had at the start. And again, I think we can see why that's happening in terms of the social and cultural pressure that's on our young adults, as well as just plain temptation and sinfulness. So all of those things are compounding together to have a really nasty ending. Now, out of all of this, if I kept sort of taking this graph through the rest of life, there would be a small creep back. But it is nothing larger than what we are seeing there. So of all of our numbers, a significant number is 74% of all people who become Christians do so before the age of 20. So it is the time of life under God that he is choosing to use to bring more people to himself than any other period of life. And we can kind of see that sociologically as well as spiritually, which is the influence of the parents is incredibly significant. It is a formative time of life where we shape our views and perspectives and values and beliefs. And all of that is coming together to be an incredible, significant time. So what I'm hoping to, I've convinced you of, is culturally, there's a lot of heavy stuff going on for our young people. It is a weighty time in our society. At the same time, it is a very significant time in the life of our young people, and so we want to make the most of it. That is true for parents, but it's also true for us as brothers and sisters in the church, or brothers in the church. How are we going to engage with that? So with those couple of things in mind, let's have a look at Titus 2. Oh, sorry, before we move on, the elephant in the room. Forgot the elephant. The elephant in the room, I think, is that as we talk about blokes engaging with the gospel with boys, that there is a deep history of abuse. And I think for guys who are here who go, how do I, you know, there's young blokes in my church, how do I share the gospel with them? How do I be a positive, godly role model and not feel like a dirty old man or not be perceived as something like that? And so there's actually a bit of a fear factor going on as well. We're also busy. There's a whole bunch of things, but I think that's the elephant. Statistically in the church, in broader society, girls are more likely to be abused at about a ratio of 7 to 1. In the church, it is almost opposite. So in the church, out of all the abuse claims that have come out of the Anglican Church in the last 30 years, it is disproportionately male who have been abused, and it's been done by males in leadership. So not necessarily clergy, but males in leadership. So it's not just momentary opportunism that this happened. That's not how abuse happens. It happens by thought-out, planned, contrived effort. And so that is reality of our culture. And so when we talk about this topic, we're going to keep that in our mind of not only what is right, but also what appears right, so that we can be beyond reproach. So we're going to keep our young people safe, but that doesn't mean we're just going to run off and also neglect them. So how do we keep those two together? And that's an awkward tension that we've got to deal with. Okay, so what are we trying to do? Hopefully in your book, you've got a passage from Titus. I've skipped the verse about ladies in the middle. Great verse. Don't want to distort the Bible, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't quite relevant for us in our topic right now. So a couple of verses are missing. I'm not trying to be a heretic. But this is what Titus has to say, and I'm then going to ask you to talk about it in your group. You, however, must teach what is appropriate to sound doctrine. Teach the older men to be temperate, worthy of respect, self-controlled, and sound in faith, in love and endurance. A little bit further down, similarly, encourage the young men to be self-controlled. In everything, set them an example by doing what is good. In your teaching, show integrity, seriousness, and soundness of speech that cannot be condemned, so that those who oppose you may be ashamed because they have nothing bad to say about us. So with the blokes around you, just from this passage in Titus, what are we called to, if we're going to engage our young blokes with the gospel, what are we called to do? 3 minutes. Go for it. So, from Titus, what did you talk about? What's our responsibility?
Walk the walk before you start talking the talk.
Okay, walk the walk, absolutely.
Before
you start talking the talk, yep. Yep. Teach what is appropriate. So where is it?
Doing what is good.
Yep, so verse 7, in everything set them an example. So important. They young people watch what we do, you know, whether we like it or not, whether we know they're watching or not. They are looking for examples and they are looking up to people. So whether you're a formal leader of a group they're in, then they're particularly going to look to you. But they are just sort of watching the life of the church and watching the life of the men in the church. For me, I used to go to church with mum, so my parents were split. When I was a young'un, and I had one particular dad who I knew. He was pretty much the only older bloke I knew in the church, but he was the dad of a friend. And I used to watch him all the time. The man who had the most significant influence was another mate's dad. And we would, you know, I was into motorbikes, obviously, and we were fixing motorbikes, and he was a very significant influence in my life. He didn't set out to be an influence. I'm sure he didn't want to be an influence. He just was. But he was a Christian bloke who I looked up to. And so whether we want the job or not, as men in the church, we've got it. So, yep, what else came from it?
Advertising saying is, you know, it's all about you. It's, rather, this is about how you behave and be something to look up to rather than a force that's being a sound truth, a truth to look to.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to keep pointing in our life, in our words, to Jesus. And that is it's so important. So we're not just moral, we're not just good, but we are pointing our young guys to Jesus. Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah.
I suppose one of the problems in today's society is the fact that when do young people go to church? What time of day?
Odds are with their youth group that they'll be in the evening. Yep.
When do the older people go?
In the morning.
Yeah. So never the twain shall meet.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I love my church. My church was fantastic, but basically my parents dropped me off at creche at birth. And I saw them at my wedding, you know. You know, and it's great. Age-appropriate ministry is brilliant, you know, because we want to engage them, you know, their age, their development stage, their culture, fantastic. But if we're going to do that, how do we still keep this principle that older people and more mature people have something really valuable to teach our young people? And not just at, you know, the leaders who are 22. Is that the peak wisdom that we've got for our young people? Now, if you're 22, don't get me wrong, you're very important. But are you it? Are you the last example we've got for our young people? Or could we live on the edge? Let's go to 35 and, you know, really blow their mind. You know, and I'll get to that in a minute. But how do we break down that it's not just a young person's game? Yep. What else from this passage? Yeah. Self-control, yep. Yeah, absolutely. So that's going to reflect in our marriages as well. But self-control is not a big cultural marker right now. In fact, self-control is self-limiting and therefore freedom-denying. And who in the world would ever deny free? Why would you do that? That's our cultural view of self-control. Why would you do that? That would be forsaking pleasure. And so, again, the example we set, the message we send our young people has to be something different, has to be a gospel message. Any others? At the back, sir.
Respecting one another.
Respecting one another. Thank you, absolutely. Again, not a big cultural feature in an individualistic culture. Are we encouraging our young people to respect older people? And we teach it and we're giving them someone who is respect worthy. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and they've got a brilliant, their energy and their passion is just contagious. Now, if you spend time with a passionate young Christian, it is an awe-inspiring thing. They'll put us to shame. My daughter, who's 11, is just an evangelistic animal. You know, she's remorseless. You know, Bibles for birthday presents, you know, it's just all on. You know, we timidly go to the parents and, oh, would you mind if my daughter gives you a Bible? You know, she's just out there. You know, a third of our kids' club is we've got to carpool them. But, you know, they're just fantastically, exuberantly on fire for the gospel. And so we want to nurture that. Now, my son's six, so he's still got a bit to go. We'll get there. Yeah. We get the picture, don't we? So this isn't a passage that's talking to fathers. It's talking to men. And it's talking to men and how we engage with younger boys, younger men in our church. Let me give you a couple of things. So making the most of the little things. And the reason I put it this way is because I think in churches, and particularly for the Anglicans, I'm an Anglican, I can bag out Anglicans, our solution to everything is to create a new program. We love a good program. So, and I know I'm going to put my foot in it, but, you know, I've got the microphone, what the heck. You know, so we go, how do we engage with men? We create men's breakfast. How do we engage women? We create women's high teas. How do we, and we just divide everything up into another program. Now, programs are good. Happy for programs. Let me support the program for the tape. Yay, the program. But is that the only way to do ministry? And I suppose what I want to encourage us to do is to think about, I can't remember who used this expression, but it's a great one. How do we use the rhythms of life? How do we use the rhythms of what we're already doing to actually take the opportunity and make the most of it? And so here's a few suggestions for the little things. There's a guy from the States, his name's Chap Clark. He wrote a book called Hurt, which was essentially reflecting on the pain of our youth and the abandonment of our youth. And he even talks about how, as parents, we're driving our kids from one activity to the next, but we're not actually spending any time with them. So we complain, oh, we spend all our time driving our kids from A to B to C to D, but really all we're doing is driving them somewhere so someone else can look after them. We're just moving them from one outsourced opportunity to the next. We're not actually spending time with our young people. Now, that's true for parents, but it also reflects a deep hurt in our young people. And he talks about an adult guarantor. And the adult guarantor, in his words, is someone who believes in you before they have good reason to do so, which sounds an awful lot like Jesus with us. While we're still sinners, Christ died for us. But he says, you know, just on the most simple things of, do we know the young people in our church? So do you know the young blokes who are at your church, who you pass in the corridor at church, who you pass at night church? Do you know their names? Can you take those simple opportunities to say hello? As you might be slightly scared of them and all the attitude that goes with it. They're just as scared of you. So it's sort of a mutual fear arrangement. But starting off with the most basic things of hi with their name. Ask questions. Ask about their life. So don't see your job as to teach them. See your job as just to get beside them. So ask them questions about their life. Hopefully build on those conversations that will start off superficial, that can start to get more significant. Ask bigger questions about their life. One of the great things about young people, and particularly junior high, we get harder as we get older, is that they are not offended by the questions we are offended by. So you can ask quite stark questions about their family. Any kid who came to youth group at Greenacre, one of my first questions was, who's in your family? And then second, is your dad your real dad? You know, is your dad your biological dad? Invariably, the answer was no if they were white Aussie. So all the white Aussie kids, that they were never living with both biological parents. It was pretty much true for the Islander guys as well. The Orthodox usually, they've got a very high view of marriage. The families were together. But they're not particularly offended by the question. As adults, we get, you know, don't get so personal, you know. You know, perhaps if I'm in your Bible study for 2 or 3 years, and then we might move on to these deep questions of, you know, how's your family? But young people, they're not as defensive. So, you know, obviously start with their world. Start with the basic things of what's important to them. And if that's footy, then talk footy. If it's, you know, computer games, talk computer games. You can ask questions. You don't have to know anything. Just ask questions. I got nothing, you know. But you can ask questions. Start with the little things and then move on to significant things. But use those little opportunities. So you haven't changed your life at all. All you've done is the blokes around you, ask about them and ask about significant things. Secondly, and perhaps a little more engaged, if you know the young people in your church, then are there opportunities to get beside their families? So you don't, if thinking child protection and all of that, you don't want to just form a relationship as an adult with a young person, because that has all sorts of potential to go wrong everywhere. But is there a single mum in your church? So I've got my wife, Sarah. Can my wife and I get to know that family where we have the mum, usually, and the kids over into our household? And that way we can get to know the whole family and not just the son. Can I help the son fix his bike with the mum there? You know what I mean? You know, we invite them over, we'll fix the bike, the girls can have tea and scones, and we can hang out as a family. One of the things I did at Greenacre, the bloke I was talking about, Mark, he got kicked out of home when he was quite young. He was quite resourceful, so he ended up using his Aus study money to get himself a room in a boarding house. And it was one house, three bedrooms with 15 people. And it literally had they'd use a sheet down the middle of the kitchen. And so half of it was kitchen and half was a bedroom. And he would basically spend his money, get his Aus study money, he'd buy smokes and two-minute noodles. And that was pretty much his diet. We would have him over for dinner each week. So he'd come over with my family, he would sit, we'd have dinner together. We talked pretty superficially, and we took him home and he went on. And we did that every week for about a year and a half. He didn't come to church. He wasn't in my SRE class at school. But it was just it was a way that my wife and I could love him. It wasn't particularly dramatic and it wasn't any real effort. And he got to know, at that stage, my daughter. And he just sat with our family. And we shared life with him. Now, he's a Christian now, and that's brilliant. But how do we love him anyway? Whether he became a Christian or not, how do we get to know him? How do we love him? How do we share the gospel? Now, that was perhaps a slightly more extreme case, but what are the opportunities that are around you? You don't need a program to go and get to know another family. You can do that just by yourself, or do it with your wife, with your kids, get involved. So there's a couple of basic things. All I want to throw out there is there are opportunities if you can look for them. So look for the opportunities in your church. Committing to the big things. So now we are getting to the program side of it, because I'm a big supporter of programs. But how can the blokes get involved? There are already programs in your church. So there is a kids club, potentially. There's a boys group. There's Sunday school. For the most part, they are being led and supported by the younger blokes in your church. And that's great, and they've got energy and enthusiasm and often time, which we don't feel we have. If you can, if you are in a position to do it, can you commit to one of those groups? Can you change something in your week, in your schedule, that makes you available? Now, there's a couple of rules of the game. One, if you're going to do it, be committed. Okay, so it doesn't help the ministry to have someone who comes in for a couple of weeks and then goes out. So it might be that you can't be committed every week. It might be you have to be committed every second week or something like that. But you need to be committed. Because in the end, what helps young ministries grow is that stability of leadership. In fact, in their world where there's very little stability, isn't that the most important spot? That you can model commitment to them in a culture that isn't committed. So part of that is week in, week out, be committed. Secondly, the person who's probably leading you is probably younger than you. and less experienced and might even know less and not be as good. But if you're going to be part of the team, you've got to submit to their leadership. So as blokes, because we want to go in and because we're all control freaks at heart, we want to come in and you've got to go in and say, how am I going to be part of the team? And how am I going to commit to this? Now, again, you might not be able to do that week in, week out, but are there other opportunities in the year? Can you get involved? Is there a kids camp that you can get involved in? Is there a father-son camp that you can get involved in? Are there opportunities that you can create that make it possible? And last one, let me go one step back. Let me talk briefly about boys-only ministry, because I think sometimes in our brain we go, that's the only solution. Boys-only ministry can be great. The only key thing to that is make sure you keep gospel at the centre. So boys-only ministry, and same with co-ed ministry, and same with youth ministry, it's not about being youth or boys or girls. It's about Jesus. It's about growing young disciples in Christ. So we don't just want them to be manly. We want them to be deep disciples of Christ. And so whatever program we do, we've got to keep that front and centre. Because we don't want them walking out in their teenage years going, those blokes were fantastic, but they don't love Jesus. Or I don't love Jesus. I just went, that was good. I had a great time. It was socially fantastic. We want them to love Jesus. Last one. Now, I haven't done this, but I've heard it done well. And I think talking with Ray Galea, they seem to have a really good setup for this. And that was they set up a structured mentoring program in their church. So they actually worked out, they got 20 blokes who are willing to be mentors and 20 young blokes who are willing to be mentored. And they put them together and they set up a program of mentoring. And so the idea was to read the Bible together, talk about life and pray. And it's not a Bible study. So the way perhaps you need to think of it is we want to keep ourselves aligned with Jesus. It's our compass, isn't it? It keeps us north. So they're not sitting down having a Bible study with them, just opening up the Bible together, talking about it, applying it to life, praying together, and they commit to doing that. I think they committed to doing it once a month, but I'm not sure. There might be an MBM person here who can tell me better. But that was a program that the church set up. Again, great opportunity. The only thing is, if you start it, you've got to stay with it. So you've got to say to the young person, we're going to do this for a year. We'll meet up once a month for a year, and this is what we'll do. Don't start with a great idea, do it twice, and then get too busy. Because that's no longer encouraging, it's actually discouraging. So it's counterproductive. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I think we've got about 6 minutes left to open it up for questions.
Thank you, John. Anyone got any questions? I think you've covered it all.
My work is done.
You could question them. What were some of those percentages?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
All of the roads are either good side clothes or older. So, I had the opportunity to talk to the young people at our church, and it didn't only help them, it helped me to understand the young people better. So my question is, you good sometimes for over to
I'm going to hope, Rodney, that you can help me.
His question is it good for an older person to help or to speak about their own experience to younger people? And he cited an example of going to the youth camp, our youth camp, where he went along for the whole youth camp and took part in that. And also gave his story about how he became a Christian.
Absolutely. Thank you for the point. It's a brilliant point. And particularly, and again, I think Lee was talking about it this morning, but know your story. you know, you don't have to do Two Ways to Live, but know your story, you can share your story. And that's a really powerful witness to anyone, adult or young person. So thank you. So, yes. Parkinson, and I believe if you look up For Kids' Sake online, you'll see the Parkinson report. It came out last year. What's particularly valuable about that is it's an Australian report. So often we get stats from the States, and we kind of know they're true-ish for us, but this is an Australian report. Yeah.
Young man, where does he get where's the opportunity?
Where does he connect? Yeah. I mean, mostly through peers is the large answer. So we know that the most significant, I suppose, evangelistic points are friendships is very significant. School scripture is perhaps the most significant institutional opportunity, to put it like that. And then, of course, uni, if we're talking 20-year-olds. So that's certainly the networks out. But it's the biggest thing I can say is encouraging and giving out young adults the courage to engage their friends. And particularly at 20, that's still a pretty big network. Yeah. Yeah.
What's causing the stress?
Yeah, there's a lot of answers to that. So there's an enormous amount of social pressure. So if you talk about what's significant to teenagers, the self-chosen peer group is incredibly significant, and so that's where a lot of the stress is coming from. A lot of life expectations. So you look at Gen X, so I'm Gen X, about a four-year-old. We're quite cynical about life. So our parents were the first generation who really split up. We're cynical about marriage, we're cynical about relationships, we're cynical about our work. Gen Y, you ask them how optimistic they are, and it's just they're just nuts. So basically they've been told from Disney that believe in yourself, follow your dreams, and it'll all come true. Unfortunately, now they're getting a bit older, they're discovering that that's not quite as true as Disney was making out. Who could have guessed? And so my generation is actually the suicide generation. We're disillusioned. The younger generation and then coming up, they're the medicated generations because this expectation is not being met. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other social issues, but for Parkinson in particular, he cites the single most significant is the breakdown of the family unit. So his canary is that, and particularly in this debate about homosexual marriage and things like that, the de facto relationship, and when that was brought into our legal structure and normalised, is the single most detrimental thing to our young people. Read the report, it's very good.
Okay, well, thanks very much, John.
Thank you.
Guys, it'll be afternoon tea soon, and just on behalf of the Men Meeting the Challenge, I'd like to take this gift.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Cheers, it's been fun.